From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Yes, the aviation security bill is more about partisan politics, ideological purity, and loyalty to the president than security.
Are House Republicans more afraid of unions than terrorists? The House rejects a unanimous Senate bill to federalize aviation security workers. Then from anthrax to AIDS drugs, AIDS activists protest the U.S. Trade Representative for championing drug company patent abuse. As the U.S. carpet bombs Afghanistan, humanitarian crisis there and Pakistan deepens, and 60 radical community activists, Sarah Jane Olson pleads guilty to charges she planted a bomb decades ago, but says she is innocent and afraid of being tried in this climate. All that and more coming up. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. American B-52s attacked frontline positions north of Kabul this morning, carpet bombing Taliban troops in the field and wave after wave of strikes. Giant plumes of black smoke rose over the Shamali Plain about 30 miles outside the city as the bombs hit. The opposition Northern Alliance said the attack appeared to be directed by U.S. forces on the ground. The assault came after the White House announced that the bombing would not stop for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Republicans are more afraid of unions than terrorists, said New York Democratic Congressmember Gary Ackerman. This after the Republican-controlled House voted yesterday for an aviation security bill that rejects making the nation's 28,000 airport security workers federal employees and thus union members, but protects the owner of the World Trade Center from lawsuits. Last week, the Senate voted 100-0 for a bill to federalize airport security workers. As the House voted, the FAA shut down part of Kennedy Airport in New York after private security workers failed to prevent several people from bringing contraband through security checkpoints. The three largest private airport security companies have been racked with abuse in recent years, ranging from corruption to massive security violations, inadequate training, and poor labor conditions for workers. The FBI has alerted law enforcement agencies in eight Western states that it's unconfirmed information that terrorists may be targeting suspension bridges on the West Coast. The Justice Department confirmed the warning yesterday after California Governor Gray Davis said law enforcement officials had credible evidence that four California bridges, including the Golden Gate, may be the target of an attack. CNN is ordering news presenters to end reports from Afghanistan with criticism of the Taliban. This after CNN President Walter Isaacson issued an edict to the network this week, saying it must balance its scarce reports of civilian death and suffering in Afghanistan with explanations of the U.S. point of view. CNN news presenters will be required to end each report about the impact of the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan with a pre-scripted formula such as, quote, "We must keep in mind after seeing reports like this that the Taliban regime in Afghanistan continues to harbor terrorists." Alternatively, they can say, quote, "The Pentagon has repeatedly stressed that it is trying to minimize civilian casualties in Afghanistan, even as the Taliban regime continues to harbor terrorists who are connected to the September 11th attacks that claimed thousands of innocent lives in the U.S., unquote. And if relevant, the news readers can balance reports of civilian deaths with formulas such as, quote, "The Pentagon has stressed that the Taliban continues to harbor the terrorists and the Taliban forces are reported to be hiding in populated areas and using civilians as human shields." Police in Istanbul used tear gas and nightsticks to break up a demonstration by university students who chanted anti-U.S. slogans and condemned the attacks against Afghanistan. Police detained 50 students. This as Turkey's foreign minister announced yesterday it would dispatch special forces trained to fight guerrillas in mountainous terrain to Afghanistan to work with U.S. troops and anti-Taliban fighters. Many of these troops gained their experience waging a brutal war against Kurds in southern Turkey during the 1990s. In which the military destroyed hundreds of villages and killed thousands of civilians. Turkey would become the only Muslim country to join the U.S.-led military campaign. Public opinion polls suggest some 80% of Turks oppose troop deployment in Afghanistan. Analysts said Turkey's decision could make securing international loans easier. An IMF delegation is due in Ankara this weekend. And striking another blow against public access to government information, President Bush has issued an executive order that allows him to keep papers of previous presidents secret, even if they want them made public. Critics call the presidential order absurd, a disaster for history, blatantly unlawful top to bottom, and a violation of the 1978 Presidential Records Act, and an ominous sign of a new era of government secrecy. Some 68,000 pages of Reagan's White House records, including vice presidential papers from Bush the Elder and papers of officials now serving in the Bush administration, were supposed to have been opened by law in January, 12 years after Reagan left office. The White House has delayed the release three times. And a Pakistan newspaper editor said today a white powder in an envelope hand-delivered to his paper last week had tested positive for anthrax spores, the first confirmed case of its kind outside the United States. An official close to the investigation and Western diplomats said there were two previous cases of anthrax in Pakistan, which has thrown its weight behind U.S. strikes in Afghanistan. And a French anthrax specialist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris has concluded that the anthrax attacks, which have claimed four lives in the United States, originated from a strain isolated by the U.S. military in Ames, Iowa, and sold on to laboratories worldwide. In an interview published in a French daily, Professor Michel Mach said experts at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, had reached this conclusion following genetic analysis on the strain found on the first victim in Florida.
War, 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 in the East and in the West. War, 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 they're putting out to the test. Hey. Can somebody tell me what we're fighting for? Ooh, yeah. Somehow, I just don't know. Hey. They're killing the children in their crazy war world. Give them a chance so they can grow. If you bomb me and I bomb you, only the bomb is gonna make it through. If you bomb me and I bomb you, only the bomb is gonna make it through.
War, War, War by Bunny Ruggs here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. The Republican-controlled House voted yesterday for an aviation security bill that does not require the nation's 28,000 airport security workers to become federal employees, but protects the owner of the World Trade Center from lawsuits. New York Congressmember Gary Ackerman commented, Republicans are more afraid of unions than terrorists, as the vote delivered President Bush a victory by approving a bill that would let him decide whether to make security workers federal employees or keep them as security guards working for private companies, though under stricter supervision. The House vote will force potentially contentious negotiations with the Senate, which voted 100-0. To federalize airport security workers last week. This would mean they would become union members. As the House voted, the Federal Aviation Administration shut down part of Kennedy Airport in New York after private security workers failed to prevent several people from bringing contraband through security checkpoints. The three largest private airport security companies have been racked with abuse in recent years, ranging from corruption to massive safety violations, inadequate training, and poor labor conditions for workers. We're joined on the phone now by Paul Hudson, founder and president of the Aviation Consumer Action Project in Washington. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you talk about the significance of the House vote?
Well, this means that the bill will have to go to conference. If the House bill should prevail, However, it would be, we believe, a real setback for getting stronger aviation security.
Can you explain what went into, you know, what went into the House's decision not to federalize the security workers?
Well, it appears that the bill had less to do with security than it did with ideological purity by the Republican leadership. They made some revealing statements that they were opposed to federalization of security because they didn't want to have 30,000 federal workers added on their watch. And they also said that they were concerned that these workers would be unionized and they would contribute to the Democratic Party.
Can you talk about the record of the private companies that employ these workers?
The record is absolutely atrocious. First of all, of the four top companies, three are foreign-owned, and the fourth one is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They're in no position to be given the responsibility for the United States national security. The largest company, Argenbright, was convicted of felonies in its operations in Philadelphia some time ago for falsifying criminal history checks and falsifying the training records of its employees. The manager, their Northeast manager, is now doing 3 years in prison. The sentencing memos indicate that this wasn't accidental. This was basically a criminal pattern in order to drive down costs and drive up profits. The same company has about 10,000 screeners in the United States. And they control the security at about 60 airports right now. And they've also been implicated in scandals in Europe, in Heathrow and other places. The screening companies hired a high-powered lobbyist, Ken Quinn, who's a former FAA counsel, and called themselves the Aviation Security Association. And they essentially were the point people in getting this bill through.
Can you explain who they were?
Well, this bill had a lot to do in the final analysis in its passage form with rewarding corporate contributors. In addition to the owner of the World Trade Center you mentioned, who was given exemption from liability, they also exempted Boeing. They exempted the screening companies from liability. And this is before we've had any investigation to determine what really went wrong on September 11th.
We're talking to Paul Hudson, founder and president of the Aviation Consumer Action Project. President Bush had personally urged moderate lawmakers to oppose the Senate approach, again, 100-0 to vote to federalize the airport workers. Bush said he needed flexibility to make airplanes safe for passengers. What does that mean?
It's unclear. I mean, we're very surprised the president has gotten behind this this very bad bill, considering the every single Republican in the Senate voted for the other bill that was rejected in the House yesterday. It may be that the administration, in some dark reaches, does not want to be actually accountable or have full responsibility for aviation security. It is, after all, a rather thankless job. If you thwart eight plots and one gets through, it still has very dire political consequences.
It was an extremely close vote in the House, something like, what was it, 218 to 214?
Yes, the final margin was four votes, but that was completely stage managed. You had several Republicans who voted for the Senate bill, which switched their votes, apparently at their leader's behest, so that the Republican version would pass.
So the federal government in the House bill would have the option to hire screeners or allow them to continue to work for private security firms, but they would receive better pay, training, and supervision. They would have to be American citizens to get their jobs. The bill would also expand the use of federal marshals on planes, secure cockpit doors, permit pilots to carry guns, and require background checks of workers with access to secure areas. They would require all of these airport security to be American citizens?
I believe they have to be American citizens for 5 years, but that's not in the Senate bill, and it's completely up in the air as to what the final version will be. Another major difference between the House bill that passed yesterday and the Senate bill that passed is the Senate bill would have aviation security in the Justice Department, which is the lead agency for domestic anti-terrorism and national security. The House bill would have it stay in the Transportation Department, where it has been, and it would go under an undersecretary of transportation reporting to Norman Mineta, who has been in charge of security up to now.
So, Paul Hudson, what do you expect will happen in the conference committee where the House and Senate bill have to be reconciled?
Well, I expect that there will be a lot of pressure to come out with a bill and put it on the president's desk within the next week or so. I don't think anyone wants to go into the Thanksgiving and holiday season without security, a new aviation security law in place. But how it turns out is still an open question.
And what Republicans were offered and a few Democrats, what promises of highways and other home pet projects they were offered to vote with the president on this?
Well, there were some Democrats that voted for the Republican bill, and mostly they seem to have been Democrats that had large aviation facilities in their districts and would benefit from some of the liability exemptions in this bill. Also, if the House bill goes through, we will probably see a feeding frenzy by some major corporations in getting contracts to do security, not only doing the screening, but also for equipment. And this is also a big impetus behind this.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Paul Hudson, for joining us. Paul Hudson is with the Aviation Consumer Action Project in Washington, D.C. And we're going to turn to another issue that's involved unions, a protest yesterday that included the AFL-CIO. AIDS activists protested. The U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zolik giving a rousing send-off demonstration 1 week before the World Trade Organization meeting in Qatar yesterday outside the offices of Robert Zolik. Health activists with ACT UP, Health Gap are connecting the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson's decision not to break Bayer's patent monopoly on the anthrax drug Cipro and Zolik's WTO negotiating with a systematic administration policy of valuing patent monopolies of drug companies over human lives. We're joined right now by Thea Lee, who is Assistant Director for International Economics at the AFL-CIO. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you so much.
Can you explain what the AIDS activist protest has to do with anthrax?
Well, the AIDS activists are protesting the use of WTO, the World Trade Organization trade rules, to prevent countries from weakening patent laws or from taking steps to provide medicines, life-saving medicines, in various health emergencies. And in the anthrax case here in the United States, when all of a sudden there seemed to be a shortage of the Cipro and the very high prices and an inability of the patented medicine to be made available, the United States was considering breaking the patent, just asking the company to break the patent and allow generic production of that drug. And I think a lot of the AIDS activists thought this was very hypocritical, because here's the United States going around the world and telling other countries like South Africa and Thailand and Brazil that they need to preserve patents at all costs, even if it means that tens of thousands of people won't have access to life-saving medicines. So it was that contrast that was very much highlighted at yesterday's protest.
Thea Lee, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We come back, we'll be joined by Chatinka Nkoma, who is co-founder of Global AIDS Alliance, who is out protesting with you outside of the U.S. Trade Representative's office. Also wanted to give just two numbers to the audience listening on public access stations around the country, as well as community radio and at WBIX.org or on the internet somewhere else. If you called in yesterday to order a copy of the Johann Galtung tape, the founder of Peace Studies, the videotape, you can call again today and there will be someone at the phone. The 800 number is 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also go on the web to freespeech.org and you can get any of the video cassettes of Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, or Johann Galtung. And also, we want to let you know that our first ever public screening of the War and Peace Report that we do every day on the radio and public access stations is going to be Saturday night, November 3rd, here in New York. The whole Democracy staff crew will turn out, along with activist rocker Patti Smith, and we'll be up near Columbus Circle at St. Paul the Apostle Church at 405 West 59th Street at 8 o'clock. That's November 3rd, Saturday night. At 8 o'clock, and we'll be showing you on the big screen the War and Peace Report, and Patti Smith will be singing. Also, my band and fired colleagues Bernard White, Robert Knight, Grandpa Al Lewis will be there again, along with the whole Democracy Now! Crew, so we hope to see you out there as well. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. We'll be back with Thea Lee of the AFL-CIO and the co-founder of Global AIDS Alliance when we come back. Clamp Down by The Clash here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero World Trade Center, the second one being Afghanistan. As we talk about one of the byproducts of the debates that have come out since September 11th in response to some of the major tragedies and attacks, and this has to do with anthrax, the controversy over the Bayer Corporation making the antibiotic Cipro and its costs and what that has come to mean in this country and how quickly the U.S. government was forced to respond to concerns about the number of pills available in this country, but also the cost. And yesterday, there was a protest outside the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick's office in Washington, D.C., for siding with Bayer. We're joined on the phone by Thea Lee, Assistant Director for International Economics of the AFL-CIO, as well as Chitinka Nkoma, co-founder of Global AIDS Alliance. Now, next week, Robert Zoellick will be in Qatar for the WTO ministerial negotiations. A controversy is the declaration crafted by more than 50 poor WTO member countries on access to AIDS and other life-extending drugs, public health, and patent rights. Chitinka Nkoma, can you talk about what you see is the relationship between the anthrax vaccine or the anthrax drug Cipro and AIDS drugs?
Well, the first most obvious relationship there is that, you know, these drugs are vital to saving lives. And at this particular time, you know, we're in a crisis that, you know, we need those drugs more than, you know, ever to save lives, the AIDS drugs to save lives in Africa and other developing countries, and the anthrax particularly to save lives here in America. So the need to have access, for everybody to have access to these two types of drugs, or categories of drugs is of utmost importance because, you know, it's threatening the lives of people.
Thea Lee, why is the AFL-CIO involved with this?
Well, we've been for a long time, as you know, protesting the trade policies of the U.S. government and of the World Trade Organization. And mostly we raise the issues around workers' rights and environmental protections, around democracy and accountability. But over the last few years, we've also become involved in the intellectual property rights disputes. And we wanted to come down on the side of our brothers and sisters in the developing countries to say, we don't want to see our government using its economic clout in the world to enforce patent rights for rich pharmaceutical companies at the expense of people's lives. And so this is really, for us, a question of solidarity and of what's right, of how it brings up for us the broader issues about U.S. trade policy, whether this is a corporate-dominated policy or one that really is serving the interests of working people around the world and certainly here in the United States, or whether it's purely in the interests of big corporations.
Chitinka and Coma, Bayer, the company that makes Cipro, was one of the corporations that sued the government of South Africa. Is that right?
Yes, it was.
And can you explain what that lawsuit was about?
Well, the South African government, 1997, tried to pass a law in this parliament, which was to allow, you know, the nation to produce generic drugs or to import them, you know, parallel import from, you know, cheaper manufacturers. And for that action, it was sanctioned and it was taken to court by the pharmaceutical companies. It fought a lot of, the battle was fought for the past, say, 5 years. And just recently, early this year, you know, part of the battle has been won. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of dark clouds, you know, still lingering. And, you know, it's just part of, you know, the first battle in a long war to save people. The importance, you know, and the double standards of Bayern and, you know, also the foreign policymakers is that the AIDS drugs, you know, issue was, you know, unfortunately considered probably, I don't know, it wasn't important enough to bring in, you know, the emergency crisis, to save the lives in Africa. And now the fourth Bayer to reduce the price of, you know, Cipro. In no due respect, you know, an important thing, you know, to enable people to live, you know, safely. I mean, to give them life, anyway. But at the same time, you know, developing countries and most importantly, Africa, which has good, you know, the largest HIV population, at this time, you know, is being refused the same access to drugs. Now, you know, this is a time when we should be reflecting on the values of a human life, because the fight against AIDS is a fight against, you know, human evils, profit-making mongers, and the fight against terrorism is also a fight against human evils that are, you know, attempting to destroy life. To preserve human dignity, you know, some compassion has to be, you know, taken in place and say, okay, fine, maybe before this is what was driving the force, but we are all in crisis. We are all being threatened, you know, with death, and over 56 million people worldwide now are infected. It's projected that in the next 5 years, 100 million people are going to have HIV and dying from AIDS.
Let me ask Thea Lee of the AFL-CIO if you were surprised when Canada overrode the patent held by Bayer for the antibiotic Cipro and ordered the generic version from a Canadian company. This put pressure on the Bush administration, and finally Bayer responded by agreeing to sell it bulk supplies the Bush administration at a deep discount. And then, of course, you had the Brazil and the case of Brazil last year at the center of the drug patent issue, since it threatened to set aside patent protections and buy generic versions of AIDS drugs from local makers because it said the brand name versions cost too much.
Right. You've seen a lot of different initiatives from different countries. Canada traditionally has had a system of compulsory licensing where they forced essentially brand name drugs to be made available as generics much more quickly than in the United States. Unfortunately, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, forced Canada to change that system. But I think there is more of a tradition in Canada of understanding the importance of getting reasonably priced generic drugs out to consumers as quickly as possible. But I think this is a whole issue why the trade discussion is so important, that when a country like Brazil tries to do the right thing, or a country like Canada, does the World Trade Organization or the United States government or the pharmaceutical companies, do they come down on these countries and essentially blackmail them into changing those policies? And that's really what we've been active against, to say we don't want to see trade rules. We don't want to see our own government use its economic clout to force countries to change rules that are working very well, to change programs. And Brazil's program of AIDS prevention has a very good track record of treatment and prevention and providing reasonably priced drugs to people who need them in a timely fashion.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I'd like to ask both if you have information, contact, website, addresses that people can go to get more information. Thea Lee of the AFL.
Our website is www.aflcio.org/globaleconomy, and that will get you right into all the trade issues and the WTO and Fast Track, which are our current battles right now.
And will you be headed to Qatar?
I am at the moment planning to go to Qatar next week to represent the AFL-CIO's interests there.
Do you expect to see much protest there, given that Qatar bans public demonstrations?
Well, given that they've not issued visas to anybody without official accreditation, and that it's very far away, expensive, and now that there are a lot of serious security concerns, I don't think anybody expects to see a lot of street protests. But it's ironic that the WTO felt they had to move this meeting to the furthest corner of the earth, to a country where trade unions are banned and most street protests are discouraged and visas are strictly controlled, and now they're facing a whole lot of security concerns that have nothing to do with street protests.
And Chitinka Nkoma, if people want to get in touch with the Global AIDS Alliance.
The website is www.globalaidsalliance.com.
And will you be in Qatar?
Unfortunately, no, I won't be in Qatar. We may have a representative there, but I spoke to the minister from my country, from Malawi, and, you know, they were very supportive of, you know, the civil society's efforts here in America to try and, you know, help African countries, you know, through this crisis. And so, you know, we will keep them in prayer, but unfortunately I won't be able to be there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us as well. As we move now to the second ground zero, and that is Afghanistan. Huge U.S. B-52s attacked frontline positions north of Kabul this morning, carpet bombing Taliban troops in the field, and wave after wave of strikes. Plumes of black smoke rose over the Shamali Plain about 30 miles outside the city as the bombs hit. The opposition Northern Alliance said the attack appeared to be directed by U.S. forces on the ground. They estimated as many as 60 bombs fell. The assault came after the White House announced that the bombing would not stop for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, saying the U.S. could not afford to postpone the attack. As the humanitarian crisis inside Afghanistan deepens, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has said he would like to see an end to the military conflict as soon as possible so the UN could carry out urgent humanitarian aid operations. Annan warned that tensions within the International Anti-Terror Alliance could intensify the longer airstrikes against Afghanistan continue. A truck convoy carrying 5,000 tons of UN humanitarian aid left Kyrgyzstan for northern Afghanistan today. The 50-truck convoy was carrying urgently needed food, medicine, and fuel. to Faizabad in Afghanistan, a city now controlled by the opposition Northern Alliance. New Zealand has also announced today it may send an Air Force Hercules as well as Army medics and engineers to help a United Nations relief effort in Afghanistan. Luke Hunt joins us now. He's in Islamabad, but he just returned from the Afghanistan-Pakistan border from Quetta. He's a reporter with Agence France-Presse. Can you describe what Quetta is like right now?
There's Quetta and then there's Shaman, which is about 100 kilometers northwest. In Shaman, you have these old refugee camps which have been inundated with new refugees who have crossed the border illegally and are taking up residence with family and relatives, and essentially slipping through the net in terms of the Pakistan authorities and the foreign aid authorities. Then at Charman, you have several camps have been allocated for the refugees, but they're basically deserted. Only the Kili Fazal, which is a temporary holding camp, there's maybe 2,000 refugees who really are the most desperate of the desperate. It's women and children. They no food, no. Well, they have food and water, some, which has been getting in there now from the aid workers, but they've been coming across in dire need of medical assistance, food and water.
Who's running these camps?
pardon me. The UNHCR is running the camps up on the border, but the Pakistan authorities are deciding who can go into the camps and who cannot. They are allowing the desperately weak mother and children across. Most of the men are being rejected. This has raised several fears that the men could be used for forced conscription on the other side at Taliban-run camps in Spinboldak.
Have you made it to Spinboldak?
No. At Charman, you can stand. You can stand right on the border. There's a 200-meter no man's land, and there's a chain which. You're allowed to get within about 6 inches of that chain, and you were told by the Pakistan military that gun sights are trained by the Taliban on you, particularly foreigners. And if you put your foot on that chain or across that chain, you will be shot.
How many Afghans are in the Taliban-run camp near the Pakistan border there?
It seems to vary from day to day. We've had reports of several hundred and then several thousand. It appears that a lot of the refugees are coming into the camp, and then they're being stuck there. We spoke to some who had been there for 6 days without medical assistance, water, food, and eventually they did manage to come across. But the stronger ones seem to be leaving the camps and then trying to make their way across the border through the more remote passes of the surrounding Kojak Mountains.
What is driving people into these camps?
Obviously the US bombings for a start. The drought is a big factor. The landscape is how one would imagine the moon. It's just barren, dry, dusty, bereft of any type of foliage. The dust storms whip up like mini tornadoes and then settle down again. And there is simply nothing there. There is no permanent water source, so the water has to be tanked in. And the food has to be delivered up as well, which is very basic, wheat flour and make your own bread.
What about this drought? How long has it been going on?
It's very real, and Pakistan has some legitimate problems, partly due to agriculture and certainly due to overpopulation, mainly by Afghan refugees over the last 10 years. The water sources have already dried up, particularly the Karizes, which are shallow water canals. Now, they are gone, and at the current rate, according to government reports, Quetta, which has 1.2 million people, will be completely deserted by the year 2020. And quite simply, there is no water there. So where do you bring these people, and how you look after them is probably, is I think, behind the scenes subject to increased political, certainly subjected to heightened political manoeuvres.
We're talking to Luke Hunt, who's just come from the Pakistan-Afghanistan border around Quetta, where he's been speaking with refugees from Afghanistan, who have made it into Pakistan. What are the refugees saying?
The refugees, it's only another 60 miles from the border to Kandahar, and Kandahar is described as a filthy mess. Those that are left behind are forced to scavenge like dogs through the ruins to find food. There is no sanitation, and that mixed with the heat of the day is quite disgusting. People are fleeing, the injured particularly, are having trouble getting to the border, those who cannot afford to pay human smugglers, and they're forced to hitch rides on anything that will move. The official figures is Kandahar is 80% deserted and Herat is 70% deserted.
And what are people saying about the U.S. bombing?
To put it in some sort of context, they have absolutely no idea about what happened on September 11th. They don't have television. It's banned by the Taliban. And even then, they couldn't afford it. These people are from the rural backwaters, and they really don't have any idea about what happened on September 11th. And from that position, they just see the Americans as an alien force coming in and bombing their country, for which they really are not sure why. And it's partly for that reason that the Taliban are able to muster a lot more support than otherwise they may have been able to. We have a report today saying that another 1,200 tribesmen, fully armed, are crossing the Pakistan border into Afghanistan to help in the Taliban's jihad.
And what do they say about Osama bin Laden?
It varies. Some adopt the attitude of the traditional Afghan. He's our guest. We haven't seen any proof of what he has allegedly done, and even then they don't understand what he's allegedly done. And therefore, why should they cower to someone else's desires and have him removed from the country? There are many others, though. I mean, bin Laden's reputation and record is to many people, and Afghans are not that stupid. I think they full well know what happened in Africa in 98, World Trade Center in 93, USS Cole in 99 or 2000, I think, I'm sorry. And they know this guy is trouble, and I think a lot of them would really like to see him leave.
We've also been hearing about the food packets that have been dropped, I think now about a million. They were yellow, like the cluster bombs that also dropped. They look like yellow cans. The food look like yellow squares. Now the U.S. government is saying that they'll change the color of the food wrap to blue, so people won't be as confused and pick up what they think is food, and it ends up being a bomb exploding in their hands. Have people talked about this?
No, they haven't. To be honest, I haven't heard. I think maybe that's. I'm under the impression that a lot of the food aid is being dropped further north. I'm also sure that there is some being dropped further south. But we haven't had any reports about food aid or food aid being picked up at all. I have seen reports about it being bought and sold on the markets closer to Kabul and in Northern Alliance held territory. But we just, to be honest, we just really haven't heard anything about this at all.
Can you talk about the level of humanitarian assistance right now in Quetta, if it exists? What's getting into Afghanistan?
We see a lot of trucks going along the road with wheat, flour, heading into Afghanistan. Its end destination, no one can confirm. Right on the border itself, in Quetta, there's an awful lot of talk about humanitarian assistance. There's an awful lot of talk about the money that has been contributed or pledged. When you get up to the camps, there's nothing there. They're a patch of desert fenced off by barbed wire with a couple of hundred plastic tents and a water tanker. It doesn't seem to reflect the talk that's been going on for the last couple of months at all.
Well, Luke, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Is there anything else you'd like to add as you return from Quetta to Islamabad in terms of the contrast, in terms of the U.S. bombing, etc., even the reporting that's going on there?
I think it's going to go on for a long time. And there does seem to be a certain amount of politicking going on with NGOs at the border. also a preoccupation with numbers, and the UN was throwing around incredible figures immediately after September 11, which I think hyped the argument, and people are expecting these hundreds of thousands to come across. The reality is 130,000 have come across the border. The UN and Pakistan authorities would like to move these people who have been absorbed into local communities with existing relatives and friends.
Luke Hunt, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Luke Hunt is Agence France-Presse reporter. He was in Quetta, has just returned to Islamabad. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about the case of Sarah Jane Olson. She has pled guilty to a bomb plot, but says she's innocent. Stay with us.
In the morning, when the moon is at its rest, you will find me at the time I love the best, watching rainbows play on sunlight, pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning. Can't you imagine it? It's the morning of my life, yeah. In the daytime, I will meet you as before. You will find me waiting by the ocean floor, building castles in the shifting sands, in a world nobody understands. In the morning, tis the morning of my life, tis the morning.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report. In the morning, Nina Simone, here on Democracy Now! In Exile. And again, a reminder, we're looking forward to seeing everyone in this area out at St. Paul the Apostle Church at 59th and 9th, Saturday night, November 3rd at 8 o'clock for the first ever public screening of the War and Peace Report. You'll see it on the silver screen, but you also see Miranda Kennedy and Anthony Sloan, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, the whole team. I'll be there as well, along with my Banned and Fired colleagues from WBAI, Bernard White, Robert Knight, Grandpa Al Lewis, and rocker activist Patti Smith will be singing live. So we hope to see people. That's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock as a Democracy Now! In Exile fundraiser and a gathering in New York of friends, listeners, and viewers on public access stations around the country in New York. We're on Manhattan Neighborhood Network today on Channel 56. And on Dish TV, we're on Free Speech TV Channel 9415. We're going to talk today about Sarah Jane Olson. She pled guilty this week to charges that she plotted 26 years ago to bomb two police cars. But upon leaving the courtroom, Sarah Jane Olson said she's innocent and that she pled guilty because it would be impossible for her to receive a fair trial in the current political climate. Prosecutors say that in 1975, Sarah Jane Olson, then known as Kathleen Salaya, was part of the Symbionese Liberation Army, a militant political group which committed a series of bank robberies and kidnappings and was accused of several murders. Six members of the group were killed by police in 1974, after which SLA members allegedly tried to plant bombs on two police cars. Sarah Jane Olson went underground shortly after, took a new name, became a community activist in Minneapolis before being arrested 2 years ago. Olson has always denied any involvement in the bomb plot, although she does admit that as a radical political activist, she knew members of the SLA. She was scheduled to go to trial when the September 11th attacks took place in New York and Washington. After the attacks, the political climate surrounding her trial shifted dramatically. Prosecutor statements attacking her as a terrorist took on enormous weight, making it impossible, Sarah Jane Olson said, for her to receive a fair trial. Federal officials are now looking at the possibility of rejecting Olson's guilty plea to reinstate tougher charges. We're joined right now by two people who've worked closely with her. Barbara Nimes is her personal lawyer, and Mary Sutton is with the Sarah Olson Legal Defense Committee. Mary Sutton, let's go to you first. Explain what happened in the courtroom with the guilty plea and then Sarah Jane Olson saying she's innocent.
First of all, I just want to clarify, I'm with the Sarah Olson Defense Fund Committee, so I'm not an attorney. I'm an organizer and a friend of Sarah's. So what came down in the courtroom is Sarah was put in a position and given a lot of advice to make a decision whether she would face a trial where she would not be likely to get an unbiased jury and be convicted on a conspiracy charge that would send her to prison for life. Rather than taking that risk, Sarah made the very difficult decision to make a guilty plea and agree to what she understands, a sentence that would probably come down to spending between 2.5 to 5 years in prison.
Well, let me ask Barbara Nimes, Sarah Jane's personal lawyer, about federal officials now saying that they are considering rejecting Olson's guilty plea to reinstate tougher charges.
Well, it's my understanding it's the state officials that are considering rejecting the plea to make the case go forward to trial. But I haven't seen any documentation on that as of yet. I know that there's been telephone calls back and forth with Sean Chapman and Judge Fiedler. And conversations with Sarah as well regarding a hearing on Tuesday, November 6th at 1 p.m.
Olson pleaded guilty to 2 felony counts of attempted explosion of a destructive device with intent to murder. The New York Times says if the judge is able to reverse his decision and reject the deal, under which the government agreed to drop 3 other felony counts, it could force her to commence a trial she and her lawyers have said they feel they cannot win. The judge's action was a surprising twist, but the Times says no more so than Ms. Olson's attitude toward her plea, insisting it was a fraud moments after entering it in clear, unequivocal tones. What is your response, Mary Sutton, to that characterization?
All this news has happened overnight, and it's not clear that Judge Fiedler can take back this deal at all. So a lot of news has happened overnight that I'm not... I haven't even seen yet. This rumor got out to the press before Sean Chapman even knew the hearing was confirmed. So what did Judge Fiedler can really do, and if he's acting because his ego is hurt and the prosecution's egos are hurt, I think their actions are making it clear how much ego is involved in this prosecution in the first place. This trial and conspiracy against Sarah Olson had been extended to such an extent that it included 22 events, alleged felony charges committed by other people. And they were going to bring in all the witnesses and all the evidence related to these alleged crimes and present them before a jury to ruin Sarah Olson's life. These events happened before she ever knew anyone in the SLA and before she's ever associated with them in any way. So we're looking at conspiracy law here and the dangers of it and how this country is choosing to use it and has used it in the past to bring down people who dissent against the government and, you know, refuse to put their head down over this. How this can turn out, I have no idea. It is an interesting twist.
Now, can you explain further what Sarah Jane Olson says she was involved with and then was not involved with in the 1970s when she was known as Kathleen Celaya?
Sarah was involved in the women's movement back in the 70s, a health, women's health collective, a program called the Food Conspiracy, where they provide organic food to people in the community. She did know Angela Atwood. She waited tables with Angela Atwood, who was one of the women killed in the firebombing in South Central L.A. by the LAPD. And they did some union organizing behind that waitressing job. Sarah was involved in a lot of things, and she was brought into this scene because her best friend was murdered by the LAPD. So she went up to Berkeley, and there was a rally in Berkeley. I would say she went there. She was there. And there was a eulogy for these people, and 20 people gave speeches commemorating the SLA. A lot of people hadn't agreed with what the SLA were doing, but they were people and people that had good intentions. They made a lot of very big mistakes, but Sarah's best friend was murdered, and she was eulogizing her friend, and she made a statement, something to the effect, "We are with you," and at that point, she was fingered and targeted, and they kept an eye on her from then on, and she made a choice to help these people escape and be safe, and that was her involvement, and you know, they've picked her up in an indictment from over 27 years ago.
Well, we'll continue to follow these cases as the developments continue. Again, Sarah Jane Olson pleading guilty to a bomb plot, but soon after that, walking out and saying, "I'm pleading guilty to something to which I am not guilty," saying she was deeply concerned about the climate since September 11th. We've been joined by Mary Sutton, who is with the Sarah Olson Legal Defense Committee, and Barbara Nimes, who is her personal lawyer. And that does it for today's program. If you called in yesterday and wanted to get a video cassette of the Johann Galtung speech, the founder of peace studies, you can call again at 1-800-926-3921 and get that speech, or one by Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky on videotape, 1-800-926-3921, or you can go to freespeech.org. As for us, we are having our big fundraiser tomorrow night in New York at St. Paul the Apostle Church. You can go to our website to find out more information at democracynow.org. We look forward to seeing you. Rocker Patti Smith will be there as well as Grandpa Al Lewis and Bernard White, Robert Knight, and the whole Democracy Now! Team. Democracy Now! And Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We're broadcasting at WBIX.org. Again, our website, newly unveiled this week, is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, to KPFA, to KFCF, and all the Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica, broadcasting in exile from the studios of WBAI, from the embattled studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
A chance so they can grow.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile.
To understand this war, we have to stop thinking about the Arab-Israeli conflict and start thinking a lot more about Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. As Mark Danner's written, the American troops and warships in the Gulf, the unpopularity of our presence there, the fragility of the regimes we support, these facts are not secrets, but among Americans, they are not widely known.
15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. The country funds charitable organizations linked to Osama bin Laden, and the country has refused U.S. access to bases. But why hasn't Washington objected? We'll talk about Saudi oil, U.S. troops, and the murky relationship between three political and economic dynasties: the Saudi royal family, the bin Laden family, and the Bush family. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan, now the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. B-52s attack frontline positions north of Kabul this morning, carpet bombing Taliban troops in the field and waves after waves of strikes. Giant plumes of black smoke rose over the Shamali Plain about 30 miles outside the city as the bombs hit. The opposition Northern Alliance said the attack appeared to be directed by U.S. forces on the ground. The assault came after the White House announced that the bombing would not stop for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Republicans are more afraid of unions than terrorists, so said New York Democratic Congressmember Gary Ackerman. This after the Republican-controlled House voted yesterday for an aviation security bill that rejects making the nation's 28,000 airport security workers federal employees, which would make them members of unions, but protects the owner of the World Trade Center from lawsuits. Last week, the Senate voted 100-0 for a bill to federalize airport security workers. As the House voted, the FAA shut down part of Kennedy Airport after private security workers failed to prevent several people from bringing contraband through security checkpoints. The three largest private airport security companies have been racked with abuse in recent years, ranging from corruption to massive safety violations, inadequate training, and poor labor conditions for workers. The FBI has alerted law enforcement agencies in eight Western states that it has unconfirmed information that suspension bridges on the West Coast may be targeted. The Justice Department confirmed the warning Thursday after California Governor Gray Davis said law enforcement officials had credible evidence that four California bridges, including the Golden Gate, may be the target of an attack. CNN is ordering news presenters to end reports from Afghanistan with criticism of the Taliban. This after CNN President Walter Isaacson issued an edict to the network this week, saying it must balance its scarce reports of civilian death and suffering in Afghanistan with explanations of the U.S. point of view. CNN news presenters will be required to end each report about the impact of the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan with a pre-scripted formula such as, quote, "We must keep in mind, after seeing reports like this, that the Taliban regime in Afghanistan continues to harbor terrorists." Alternatively, they can say, quote, "The Pentagon has repeatedly stressed that it is trying to minimize civilian casualties in Afghanistan, even as the Taliban regime continues to harbor terrorists who are connected to the September 11th attacks that claimed thousands of innocent lives in the U.S. And if relevant, the news readers can balance reports of civilian deaths with formulas such as, quote, "The Pentagon has stressed that the Taliban continues to harbor the terrorists and the Taliban forces are reported to be hiding in populated areas and using civilians as human shields." Police in Istanbul used tear gas and nightsticks to break up a demonstration by university students who chanted anti-U.S. slogans and condemned the attacks against Afghanistan. Police detained 50 students. This as Turkey's foreign minister announced yesterday it would dispatch special forces trained to fight guerrillas in mountainous terrain to Afghanistan to work with U.S. troops and anti-Taliban fighters. Many of these troops gained their experience waging a brutal war against Kurds in southern Turkey during the 1990s, in which the military destroyed hundreds of villages and killed thousands of civilians. Turkey would become the only Muslim country to join the U.S.-led military campaign. Public opinion polls suggest some 80% of Turks oppose troop deployment in Afghanistan. Analysts say Turkey's decision could make securing international loans easier. An International Monetary Fund delegation is due in Ankara this weekend. Striking another blow against public access to government information, President Bush has issued an executive order that allows him to keep papers of previous presidents secret, even if they want them made public. Critics called the presidential order absurd, a disaster for history, blatantly unlawful top to bottom, a violation of the 1978 Presidential Records Act, and an ominous sign of a new era of government secrecy. Some 68,000 pages of Reagan's White House records, including vice presidential papers from George Bush Sr. and papers of officials now serving in the Bush administration, were supposed to have been opened by law in January, 12 years after Reagan left office. The White House has delayed the release three times. Bone Thugs and Harmony singing Edwin Starr's War here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. military continues to bomb Afghanistan, U.S. officials announced last week that 15 of the 19 men who hijacked the four airplanes involved in the September 11th attacks hailed from Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden, who President Bush has named as the prime suspect in the September 11th attacks, is from Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government has allowed Saudi-based Muslim charitable organizations to funnel money to al-Qaeda. Since September 11th, Riyadh has refused pleas from Washington to freeze Osama bin Laden's assets and those of his associates. The capital, Riyadh, has so far refused to cooperate fully with Washington's investigations of hijacking suspects, and Saudi Arabia has barred Washington from using Saudi air bases to launch attacks into Afghanistan. But Washington has hardly mentioned Saudi Arabia. Today we're going to spend the hour looking at the Saudi-U.S. relationship, past and present. And we're joined by a number of people on the phone and in our Firehouse studio. We'll begin with Bob Vitalis, who's director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, working on a forthcoming book called America's Kingdom. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much.
So let's start off by just talking about Saudi Arabia and September 11th.
Okay. As far as I can see, the war against the United States in Saudi Arabia has been going on not since September 11th, but for almost a decade. I mean, if you understand the war narrowly, or if you understand the problem narrowly as bin Laden and his closest supporters, or, that is a conflict rooted in the American presence in the Gulf and how Saudis understand that presence to be the key support for the regime itself, and how those Saudis who are opposed to the regime seek to replace it with a different kind of government. And so the war, if you think about it, bombings in 93 here in New York, but perhaps much more importantly, bombings of American installations in Riyadh in 1995, in 1996 in Dahran, also in Saudi Arabia, then the bombings in American installations beyond the Gulf, the bombing in Yemen in 2000. This has been going on for some time. It's not September 11.
Gwen Arlulik joins us on the phone, professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, has done extensive field work in Saudi Arabia. Can you talk about why the United States has not cracked down on Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think we need to be careful in assuming that the United States hasn't. In fact, Saudi Arabia did freeze the accounts of 66 individuals, companies, and charities. So I think, in fact, Saudi Arabia is doing what they can. That being said, there's a profound sense of embarrassment in the country right now and a lot of posturing. For its part, Saudi Arabia is maintaining what some people are calling a conspicuous silence in this war on terrorism, and I think it's for two important reasons. One, the ruling family has domestic constituencies that it must respond to, and it fears the domestic repercussions of a close relationship with the United States. That's very important. But secondly, Saudi Arabia, you know, by virtue of being the guardian of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, has an international leadership role in the Islamic community, and it must pay attention to that role. So it's made for a lot of posturing between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Fareed Mohammadi is with us as well, chief economist with a petroleum finance company. Can you talk about how much oil the U.S. buys from Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia's role in OPEC?
I don't think it's that important on how much oil the U.S. directly buys from Saudi Arabia. That's Saudi exports directly to the U.S. around 1 million barrels a day, and we consume 20 million barrels a day. That's not the issue. The issue is Saudi Arabia is a very important oil producer in the world, and the oil markets are very much linked. Changes in oil supply and demand anywhere in the world have an impact on prices. And this is why Saudi Arabia, because of its presence in the market size-wise and its presence in OPEC, can moderate or increase the price of oil quite easily, especially if it works well with its OPEC partners. And that's why it's important to the United States, and it has played this role for the United States. It has kept excess capacity for times when you have disruptions, like when Iraq invaded Kuwait and they needed to come in and replace that oil that was on the market. So from a global market management point of view, Saudi Arabia is very important.
During the Persian Gulf War, right before President Bush Sr. Was marketing different ideas for the bombing, or rationales, and one of them was to protect national security, which was oil. In the end, he had to go with some more than that, but that was certainly out there in what a lot of people think. Is that what you think?
Yeah, I think that the fact that Saddam now, Saddam Hussein at that time controlled the 3 million that he produced, the 3 million that Kuwait produced, the potential for threatening the around 6 to 8 million that the Saudis produced. That was a significant amount of oil and money that could then go into his treasury to buy arms and all of that. And that, I think, was one reason that the Bush administration was concerned about that invasion.
Bob Vitalis, why are you calling your book America's Kingdom?
Because I'm writing about the early days of the American relationship. It's a, you know, it's a relationship that goes back now more than 50 years. It's the closest relationship we've had in the Middle East. It's also the first relationship. It predates the one with Israel that we most think about. And in those early days, it was a very different world from the world we see today. But those early days, like the early days in the United States themselves, are shrouded in myths. And the book is about trying to explode some of those myths.
Well, explode some of them.
Sure,
first.
I'll be happy to. The first and most important is Saudi Arabia was not always a wealthy country. It was not the country that it looks like today. And when American firms first opened up the oil fields there, they actually founded the city of Dahran, where soldiers had been bombed. We don't think about the American companies having such a strong role, but the role they played there originally looked quite like the role mining companies have played in other mining frontiers of the world, in Mexico, in southern Arizona, in New Mexico. in Baku. And in Saudi Arabia, like in all those other places, the American firms basically had instituted a, what, for lack of a better term, is an apartheid regime or a Jim Crow kind of system in place in the camps. Saudis themselves were treated as second-class citizens. They were discriminated against. Americans would not allow them in American parts of the compounds. And what's most important about that moment is, in a way, that Saudis themselves then began the movement to reverse that kind of a harsh rule by the companies in a state that was not yet a consolidated state. And they did that through a labor movement that has now been forgotten, strikes that have now been forgotten, and basically a process of reversing that kind of discriminatory order that has also now been forgotten for many reasons.
And what was the U.S. role in all of this?
Well, the United States follows the oil companies to Saudi Arabia. You can think about it this way. Without the oil companies actually have gotten getting a toehold in Saudi Arabia in the 1930s and 40s, there would have not been any U.S. presence. So the U.S. government's presence begins by following, subsidizing the oil firms at the time, trying to reduce the cost of opening up these fields and basically supporting it in what then began to get constructed as the national interest.
And then take it up through the Bush dynasty, if you will, as we look at the Saudi royal family and the Bushes.
Fair enough. The relationship has been tight for a long time. The important thing for us to think about is that, as I said, that kind of a strongly imposed order by the United States at a particular moment has been reversed. That's been reversed over time. So, for instance, the Saudis now own their own oil companies. The American firms are out of the country as owners in those firms. It is now 100% Saudi-owned company. Saudi Arabia is now very wealthy. You hear in the kinds of tensions that you described in the beginning of this segment about the Americans being angered that the Saudis are not cooperating fully, the Saudis seeming to go out of their way to block U.S. efforts, investigations, et cetera, are a reminder of the kind of lack of influence the United States now has on the Saudis in relation to the past. There's a kind of basic relationship that continues to exist, and that's the one that matters for Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. in a way. There's a bargain that exists. The United States promises to protect the Saudi regime from its external enemies, real and imagined, if you will, and in return, as Fareed has pointed out, the Saudis promise to support a kind of be a moderating influence in the world oil markets, not running the price of oil too low that it destroys the Texas and Southwest economy, and not too high that it destroys Eastern, Western manufacturing firms and the global economy more generally.
Professor Akrulik of the University of Arkansas, can you elaborate more on the Bush relationship with the Saudi royal family?
Well, I think that relationship, of course, goes back to his father and to old oil ties. So in that sense, of course, I think there are historic understandings and relationships between men and the family, so to speak. I would like to build on Bob Vitalis's comments and Fareed's about the U.S.-Saudi oil relationship. I think what's happened is that it's Saudi Arabia has concentrated so much effort on preserving stable, cheap supplies of oil for the West. What they've neglected to address are very real social, economic, and political problems in the country. And that's what people today are screaming about. They want the ruling family to address internal grievances and not pay so much attention to the relationship with the United States. So, in fact, oil is in some way related to today's grievances.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Chris Ayres, the New York correspondent for The Times of London. He's actually working from his home in New York. He is usually has an area at the New York Post where The Times of London, I guess, rents space. But because the New York Post, there has been anthrax found there, though people continue to work there, and he's right next to the mailroom. He is working from home. And we're going to hear him talk about his investigations into the Carlyle Group. It's not very well known, though it has a tremendous amount of money, and most importantly, the political figures who lead it are none other than George Bush Sr., the former president, and we're going to look at those who fund it, or I should say have funded it, because the Bin Laden Group was just forced to pull out. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. We are talking to Professor Gwen Akrulik of the University of Arkansas, Fareed Mohammadi, who is chief economist with the Petroleum Finance Company, and Bob Vitalis, writing a book called America's Kingdom, director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Stay with us.
You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. With backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue.
Backlash Blues, Nina Simone here on the War and Peace Report. And I hope people will come out and join us on Saturday night at the Democracy Now in Exile's silver screen event, which is the War and Peace Report being unveiled publicly for the first time. We've been broadcasting on public access stations around the country and on community radio stations, as well as on the internet at WBIX.org. Now on the silver screen, and we're going to be joined by rocker Patti Smith, who will be singing, as well as some of my Band and Fired colleagues at WBAI, Bernard White, Robert Knight, Grandpa Al Lewis, and the whole Democracy Now! Team. That is Saturday night, November 3rd. That's tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at St. Paul the Apostle Church, which is on 9th Avenue and 59th Street, and it'll be at 8 o'clock. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get information, unplugged and uncensored. You'll be hearing and watching the speeches of Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn, as well as conversations with a number of the people we've had over the last month, and most importantly, honoring those that are working behind the scenes, like Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, Brad Simpson, and the whole video team that has been doing this unprecedented public media collaboration. We're talking today about Saudi Arabia. And before you leave, Fareed Mohammadi, chief economist of the Petroleum Finance Company, can you talk about the U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia, how much Saudi Arabia has spent on building them over the last decades?
Well, the Saudis reportedly have bought something like and built bases worth, so the combination of arms and infrastructure, of something like $400 billion in the last 25, 30 years. So as Bob said, we provide external protection for the kingdom, but they also pay for it. And that's a very important part of our relationship. That has been, in a sense, downgraded since the mid-90s. And I'd like to say that the relationship that the Saudis were signaling to the U.S. was that we want to buy less arms because we can't afford it. But now we will allow your companies to come in and participate in our economy because now, as Gwen said, that the emphasis is changing to economic development more. So the emphasis is on growth. And one of the significant things that happened in the last 2 years was that U.S. companies were permitted to come back and explore and develop the gas sector in Saudi Arabia. But interestingly enough, enough, and this shows how much the relationship has changed between American oil companies and Saudi Arabia, and a recognition in Riyadh that there is a European force out there, a European presence out there, economically, politically in the world, that they allowed European companies like Shell and BP to come in. So Saudis are rearranging their, reorienting their economic relations or their political relation into an economic relation, and also changing it geographically from not so much a dependence on the U.S., but also an alliance with, economic alliance with the Europeans.
So the Saudis spent $350 billion since the 70s on these bases?
Yeah, and arms, bases, etc. And that's what we, the U.S., used to fight the war against the Iraqis in 1990-91.
And not only the Saudis' role in providing oil in the world, Saudi Arabia, but also its role in OPEC.
Right. I mean, that's where it's really important.
When you look at what's happening today with the U.S. bombing on Afghanistan and very little emphasis on what's happening in Saudi Arabia, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that the U.S. has been sort of surprised at how the Saudis have been trying to distance themselves. And I think that's why you see so many news reports, because there are mid-level bureaucrats that are leaking this stuff to the press. But I think that the amazing thing to me is that the U.S. has not paid attention to what has been going on now for nearly 6 years. This distancing has been going on for 6 years. Anyway, that I think is really the surprising issue, that the U.S. has this important relationship in the Middle East, but has really, in a sense, neglected it on many levels, thinking about it in a sophisticated way.
Well, we're going to turn now to Chris Ayres. There was a piece months ago, certainly before September, I think it was in March, in the New York Times, a front page piece that said, during the presidential campaign last year, former President George Bush took time off from his son's race to call Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at a luxurious desert compound outside Riyadh to talk about American-Saudi business affairs. Mr. Bush went as an ambassador of sorts, but not for his government. In the same way, Mr. Bush's Secretary of State, James Baker, recently met with a group of wealthy people at the elegant Lanesborough Hotel in London to explain the Florida vote count. Traveling with the fanfare of dignitaries, Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker were using their extensive government contacts to further their business interests as representatives of the Carlyle Group, a $12 billion private equity firm based in Washington that's parlayed a roster of former top-level government officials, largely from the Bush and Reagan administrations, into a money-making machine. In a new spin on Washington's revolving door between business and government, where lobbying by former officials restricted but soliciting investments is not, Carlyle has upped the ante and taken the practice global. Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker were accompanied on their trips by former Prime Minister John Major of Britain, another of Carlyle's political stars. With door openers of this caliber, along with shrewd investment skills, Carlyle has gone from an unknown in the world of private equity to one of its biggest players. Private equity, which involves buying up companies in private deals and reselling them, is a high-end business open only to the very rich. Over the last decade, the Carlyle empire has grown to span three continents and include investments in most corners of the world. It owns so many companies that it's now, in effect, one of the nation's biggest defense contractors and a force in global telecommunications. Its blue-chip investors include major banks and insurance companies, billion-dollar pension funds, and wealthy investors from Abu Dhabi to Singapore. Well, in the last few days, the family of Osama bin Laden is close to ending its relationship with the Carlyle Group, the U.S. investment group. It's understood that Carlyle Group and the Saudi bin Laden Group, the Middle Eastern conglomerate owned by the family of bin Laden, have decided to part company by mutual consent. Well, today to look at the Carlyle Group and the relationship between Bush and the Bin Ladens, we're joined by Chris Ayres, who is the New York correspondent for the Times of London. Chris Ayres, the Bin Laden family says it's disinvesting from the Carlyle Group. Is this significant?
Okay, well, this is very, very significant, mainly for the Saudi Bin Laden Group as opposed to the Carlyle Group. I mean, I think it's the Carlyle Group that has ended its ties with the Bin Laden family rather than the other way around. I think that the Bin Laden Group's investment in Carlyle became really extremely embarrassing after September the 11th. We don't really know how much money Bin Laden had in the Carlyle Group. We think it's probably less than $10 million. We think they had an investment in some of Carlyle's military funds. And I don't know if you're familiar with Carlyle, but Carlyle is a huge fund manager. It has $12 billion or so of cash that it invests on behalf of its clients. And some of this Bin Laden money, we think, was put into military contractors in the U.S. And so, as a result, the Bin Laden family of Saudi Arabia could actually be said to be profiting indirectly from the war in Afghanistan. So it was a very tricky situation for Carlyle, which has an extremely close relationship with the Saudi royal family and with the Saudi Bin Laden Group, which, of course, has disowned Osama Bin Laden. But I think they felt that it was just too much of a controversial relationship to continue and that they had to get out of it as soon as they could.
Can you talk about the other side of the Carlyle Group, and that is the political figures who run it?
Well, the Carlyle Group is political through and through. Perhaps the first sort of well-known American political figure to join Carlyle Group was Frank Carlucci, who, of course, is Reagan's former defense secretary. He came on board in about sort of the late 80s, 1989, and then he sort of set about sort of attracting lots of other high-profile political figures. The best known, of course, is George Bush Sr., who came on board to Carlyle sort of in the mid to late 90s. And John Major, the former British Prime Minister, and I believe they have sort of various other sort of former prime ministers from the Middle East and the Far East, and it is a political powerhouse. It's an absolutely astonishing organization, given the number of sort of movers and shakers on its board, in particular its advisory board, who act as sort of very high-level door openers for the company, and can get it into the most the top-level government decision-making process.
Most significantly, what about George Bush Sr.?
Well, we don't really know what George Bush Sr. does exactly. I mean, he's said to be on the advisory board. We know that very recently he went to Saudi Arabia with the Carlyle Group. He spoke to King Fahd. As far as we know, that was an entirely separate matter. Carlyle says that he was not there in that meeting to promote Carlyle, but they do say that people from Carlyle were in Saudi Arabia at the same time, and some deal making did go on after the meeting. So really, George Bush Senior is just an ambassador for the group. I mean, he's just a fantastic door opener. They call them access capitalists. They give Carlyle Group fantastic access into countries like Saudi Arabia. And, Carlyle can benefit in all kinds of ways, mainly if a government decides to privatize things or deregulate its energy market or open up some areas to private enterprise. If you're with Carlyle and you've got President Bush, the former President Bush, with you, that gives you an amazing advantage in getting into these new business areas.
How did Saudi Arabia get involved with the Carlyle Group?
It's not clear exactly when they first began their sort of relationship with Carlyle Group, but what Carlyle Group does is it goes around the world looking for wealthy people who want to invest money in their funds. And of course, a lot of extremely wealthy people live in the Middle East, and so it's natural that the Carlyle Group would have gone to the Middle East to try and get people, such as the Bin Laden family, to invest money in their funds. Their most famous relationship is with Prince Al-Waleed, a very famous Saudi investor, who approached the Carlyle Group. Well, we think it might have been the other way around, but Prince Al-Waleed approached the Carlyle Group because he wanted to take a stake in Citigroup, the large bank. And Carlyle Group helped Prince Al-Waleed take a stake in Citigroup, which was an extremely difficult transaction to do because of foreign ownership laws on banks. And anyway, the transaction was a huge success, and it's thought that Prince Al-Waleed made an $8 billion profit on the deal, which not only really made Prince Al-Waleed's reputation in the West as a very savvy investor, but it also really announced the arrival of Carlyle Group on the scene. You know, in Wall Street, it really hadn't been taken seriously until then. They thought of it as just a sort of retirement home for former Republican politicians. And when they did this deal, everybody suddenly sort of looked up and said, my God, they are actually, they can really do it. They can, they're good investors. So I think that was really the deal that made their link with the Middle East and made their link with Saudi Arabia.
You write about the Carlyle Group being involved, for example, with the $12 billion arms contract with the U.S. Army. And here you have George Bush Sr., who is involved with attracting investment for it, whose son is ultimately responsible for awarding U.S. arms contracts. On the other hand, those that are financing it. Maybe more significant is just overall the involvement of the Saudi royal family than specifically the bin Ladens, who have claimed that they are not connected to Osama bin Laden, or they've disowned him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is the United Defense contract you're talking about, I presume. This is, and even before September the 11th, this was an extremely interesting contract. United Defense is owned by Carlyle Group. In fact, Carlyle Group plans an IPO of United Defense, if I'm right in thinking. They've been in the running for this $12 billion contract for the Crusader, which is a piece of very high-tech artillery. And they've been in the running for this contract for a long time. And it's often been said that it's just very odd to have a company making this kind of contract bid when the father of the president is on the company's advisory board, but also there's other links between Carlyle and the Bush administration. For example, Frank Carlucci, I think, was on the same wrestling team at Princeton University as Donald Rumsfeld, and the two are very close friends. So every time the two of them meet together, there's always questions of, are they doing some kind of backroom deal about the Crusader project? Of course, all this is denied vehemently by Carlyle Group. But nevertheless, the question remains, and it doesn't seem, to many, it doesn't seem like an appropriate relationship for Bush to have, with the Carlyle Group. I've totally forgotten what the other question was.
Talking about both Bush's involvement, Bush Sr., in getting these billions of dollars worth of contracts, Army mm-hmm. contracts, and of course his son doing the ultimate mm-hmm. awarding since he's the commander-in-chief. And then the question of the bin Laden family, which has disowned, they say, mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden. And perhaps more significant is just the overall Saudi royal family involvement.
Yeah. Well, we don't know what the Saudi royal family's involvement is with Carlyle now. And I should imagine if Carlyle is so sensitive about its relationship with the Saudi bin Laden group that it's really not going to be engaging in a huge amount of business with the Saudi royal family. For fear that it'll bring about the same questions. All U.S. companies are extremely sensitive about doing business with anybody who might have any vague connection to terrorism. Not only from a lawful point of view, but just from a public relations point of view, it just looks so bad. And we've seen sort of many companies distancing themselves from the bin Laden group because of that. Others, of course, have kept their relationships, but I think the trend will definitely be for people to simply back away. And as regards George Bush Sr.'s involvement in getting big military contracts for Carlyle, I mean, Carlyle would argue that that Bush has really no involvement whatsoever, and that he is simply an advisor on their board, and that he doesn't sort of phone up his son and say, look, can you just make sure that we get this contract? They would say that would be an absurd allegation. Of course, to the outsider, it all looks incredibly cozy, and that's really the problem. It's how outsiders perceive the relationship with George Bush Sr. And and companies such as United Defense and the arms contracts that have been awarded, and the appearance is that, you know, that little backroom deals are being done, whether that's correct or not. It just looks bad, and a lot of people have pointed this out, but so far Carlisle has really taken no notice and is going about its business as it always has.
We're talking to Chris Ayres. He is with the Times of London in New York, has been investigating the Carlisle Group. Among its heads is former President George Bush. Among its funders until this past week has been the Bin Laden family. We'll come back to this discussion when we return. I also want to let you know, for those of you who have been calling in for the Johann Galtung speech, a video cassette copy of it, as well as the Noam Chomsky speech, a major anti-war speech he gave, and one by Howard Zinn, you can order a cassette copy, a video cassette, by calling 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also go to freespeech.org to order a video cassette of either the founder of peace studies, Johann Galtung, Howard Zinn, or Noam Chomsky. That's freespeech.org or 1-800-926-3921. And again, look forward to seeing you tomorrow night at the Democracy Now in Exile War and Peace Report showing, along with live singer Patti Smith and the whole Democracy Now! Crew up at Columbus Circle area, the Church of St. Paul the Apostle at 405 West 59th Street on 9th Avenue. That's Saturday night at 8 p.m. We'll come back to Chris Ayres in a minute.
Who held the rifle? Who gave the orders? Who planned the campaign to lay waste the land? Who made the bullet? Who paid the taxes? Tell me, is that blood upon my hands? Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. All on board. If 500,000 mothers went to Washington and said, bring our sons home without delay, would the man they came to see say he was too busy? Or would he say he had to watch a football game?
This is Last Train to Nuremberg, Joel Raphael Band, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the discussion of the Carlisle Group and the Bush family, we are talking with Chris Ayres, who's with the Times of London. Can you tell us about the one member of the Bin Laden family who is left in the United States, Abdullah Bin Laden?
Well, I mean, there's not an awful lot we know about Abdullah Bin Laden, apart from the fact that he's obviously got a lot of guts to stay behind in America. I mean, I think that 11 of his family fled on September the 11th, or immediately after September the 11th, and he stayed. He lives in the Boston area. In fact, he lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's, you know, donated a lot of money to Harvard University. He invests in a lot of sort of new economy companies in the Boston area. He has stakes in biotechnology companies, we think. But as for this sort of Saudi Bin Laden group in America, which he seems to be in charge of, you know, I mean, the company seems to have pretty much shut down. I mean, its website is up for sale. The web address is up for sale. The phone line's been disconnected, and he's extremely hard to get in touch with because, I mean, he presumably fears for his life. So whether or not he'll stay here for any length of time really remains to be seen.
You talked about his seeking advice and better PR after September 11th and calling, for example, advisors in law and political consulting, among them an influential New York lawyer named Stanley Arkin, who turned him down.
Yes, I think that the Bin Laden group has been trying to get public relations advisors, not only in New York but in London as well, in an attempt to, you know, to make the point that the Bin Laden Group has nothing to do with Osama Bin Laden. But as far as I know, I mean, all the people, all the lawyers and the PR people that he's contacted have simply said, look, we don't want to take on this job. It's just too controversial. And you can kind of understand why. I mean, it's just such a sensitive time at the moment. But at the same time, I mean, a lot of people think that the Bin Laden Group hasn't been very good in putting its side of the argument forward. I mean, there haven't been sort of many public statements from the Bin Laden Group, and we certainly haven't seen any sort of detailed sort of statements just saying, you know, we have nothing to do with Osama. You know, we've been in business in America, and we, you know, we like doing business with America, and we have nothing against America. We haven't seen anything like that. I mean, obviously, by trying to get, you know, trying to hire spin doctors in America, they've sort of made some kind of effort, but still, they've just been incredibly quiet. And I think that's partly a result of Saudi culture. You know, they're just not used to having to sort of have the sort of communication strategies that Western companies are used to having. But I think that if they're going to remain in America, and if they're going to continue doing business in America, they're going to have to get to grips with this pretty quickly. Otherwise, people are just going to associate them with Osama, and they're not going to want to have anything to do with them.
Now, you write that the Saudi Bin Laden Group, a corporate giant with tens of thousands of employees and business dealings with companies like General Electric and Motorola, biotech companies like, Hybridon, a biotech company in Cambridge in which a Bin Laden brother has a small stake. What happens to all of these companies and their investments there?
Well, I mean, some of these companies just aren't in the position, like Carlyle is, to say, look, we don't need your money, go away. They're just, you know, especially startup companies, I mean, they need their investments. And they see absolutely no reason to sever their links with the Bin Laden Group. So I think a lot of companies, a lot of smaller companies will keep their relationships. It'll be interesting to see what companies like Motorola do and Nortel Networks do, who have, you know, fairly extensive relationships with the Bin Laden Group, as has General Electric. So far, I mean, they seem to be reviewing their relationships, but not doing anything. There's a lot of Wall Street banks as well, who obviously handle money on behalf of the Bin Laden family. And I mean, we'll just see over coming months what happens. I mean, I suspect that a small amount of business will still be done, but a lot of it, especially the most high profile. Links and connections and deals and partnerships will just be quietly closed down.
We've been speaking with Chris Ayres, New York correspondent for the Times of London, as he writes about the Carlyle Group. This week, the Bin Laden Group has pulled out of funding of the Carlyle Group. Among the major figures in Carlyle Group are the former British Prime Minister John Major and the former President of the United States and father of current President of the United States, George Bush. We are still joined in the studio by Bob Vitalis, who's Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and on the telephone by Gwen Okrulik, who is Professor of Political Science at the University of Arkansas. Bob Vitalis, can you put the Carlyle Group and the U.S. relationship with it through the Bushes into the larger context of the Saudi Arabian-U.S. relationship?
Sure. I think this was one example of a larger process, and let me describe it for you. First, you need to think the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia explodes the kind of image we have of typical U.S. relations with third world countries. It's the opposite, okay? Third world countries, say, depend on the U.S. for largesse, money, aid, et cetera. You call it development, whatever you want to call it. And in return, you get the kinds of complexes that we see all around the world, people acting like colonialists on beaches, running brothels, using bases, et cetera. That's not the relationship in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia gives us resources. We're dependent on them almost in some sense. That's the significance of what Chris is describing. This works. They pay for whole defense lines to keep running in the United States. When they buy U.S. arms, they're not buying those arms because they need them for their own defense. Everyone knows this is not true, including the arms dealers, the vice presidents of the firms that I've interviewed. The Saudis are buying the arms because they make them cheaper for the Pentagon. They provide jobs in the United States, in particular parts of the country that are hurting in the mid-90s as the arms industry was going through their kind of decline in a way. The Saudis understand this very sophisticatedly. There's money to be made in Saudi Arabia. That's what Chris is describing, or money to be made in relationship with Saudis. Saudis are invested all over the United States. When we buy oil from Texaco firms, that's not an American firm anymore. Those the gas station pumps, those are Saudi owned. Prince Al Walid, who came here and offered Rudy Giuliani $10 million, is a major investor in this country and around the world in all sorts of places. Disneyland, he tried to buy MCA Studios at one point. He owns Saks. He owns department stores. He owns hotels. Think about Halliburton after the Gulf War, all the money they made in Saudi Arabia as a gift, basically. So,
and of course, Halliburton was headed by Dick Cheney, who's now the vice president.
Exactly, and his stock went up. Many, many Americans have gotten rich in partnerships with Saudi Arabia. There's a kind of swinging door. The Saudis are not surprised by this. They buy compliance and allegiance in their own country by doling out funds to the middle classes. Saudi Arabia is a welfare state. It's an extension of the principle, and they use it to buy Americans' allegiance in some sense.
Well, let's turn to Professor Akrulik about the situation inside Saudi Arabia with the Saudi people, the allowance of dissent, etc.
Well, I think there have been two watershed moments in recent Saudi politics. One was in 1979 when Juhayman el-Otaibi forcibly took over the Great Mosque in Mecca, and he had to be rooted out with military force. This began a period of increased social and political tension in the country. And then in 1990-91 with the Gulf War, that was the real turning point in Saudi domestic politics. The presence of U.S. bases just fueled domestic opposition. And the 1990s were a difficult decade. It was a period of demonstrations, the rise of Islamist opposition. Very prominent religious sheikhs were jailed because of their sermons and the khutbas that they were issuing. King Fahad, of course, had a stroke in 1995. So in the middle of all this opposition, there was the absence of leadership within the ruling family. So the 1990s were tremendously difficult, and it was the presence of the U.S. bases that galvanized dissent. So what we're left with today, I think, is best described as a very fertile field for dissent. There's a lot of social and economic distress and exclusionary politics.
And what about the response to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan? Now, the Saudi government has not allowed the bomber planes to leave from Saudi Arabia, but what about the response of the people?
Well, I think that's the reason those U.S. bases are not being used, because of the fear of domestic repercussions. Bob was absolutely right in talking about those weapons purchases. The weapons purchases are perceived among Saudi Arabians to be forced upon them. They don't want them. They want to use their national resources to build their own country, not to purchase U.S. weapons. So the bases and the weapons just engender domestic dissent, and that's why they're not being used.
Bob Vitalis, can you describe what petrodollars are?
Sure. Saudi Arabia is an oil producing company. It sells oil, producing country, sorry, not a company. It produces oil, sells it on the world market, and oil is sold on all world markets now for dollars. So we refer to petrodollars as the income streams to oil producing countries during those big boom days of the 70s and then again in the 80s when oil prices went so high. This is the interesting thing about petrodollars, or let's say Saudi dollars, the money Saudis earn on oil income. No matter how big a development effort they attempted to begin in the 1970s and 80s, and Saudi Arabia is this transformed place, it's this 21st century looking monstrosity, or you think it's a beautiful thing, but it is not, you know, a kind of desert kingdom anymore. It's a vast complex of housing, shopping malls, apartment buildings, firms, and so on. Despite the largeness of that development effort, Saudi Arabia Arabians had more dollars than they could still sink into their own country. So that meant it had to be spent somewhere. Now, where was it spent? Both private individuals and the government itself invested abroad in all sorts of places. This is the story we've been telling here. So banks are dependent on Saudi investments in the 70s and 80s of these petrodollars, the recycling of these funds. You know, the money's coming from the West, who's buying Saudi oil, and then going back to the West in the forms of consumer purchases, the Saudis spending it on real estate purchases, the Saudis giving money away, development efforts, and so on.
Do you think there's any significance to the fact that the majority of the hijackers of September 11th, something like 15 of 19 of them, were Saudi?
Yes, that's, I think, how I started the show and kind of the talks I've been giving all around the country now. This is a war or a conflict that's, for a lot of people, is located, is locally based for all the different participants in these terror networks, or what you'd prefer to call them. In other words, if Osama bin Laden, or bin Laden himself, and his close allies from Saudi Arabia, their target first and foremost is the Gulf. The Egyptian comrades of Osama bin Laden, again, their targets is for first and foremost Egypt, in a way. These are kind of, if you want, nationalist religious projects, feudal ones, because they can't target their regimes directly. Osama bin Laden and his comrades are not in Saudi Arabia fighting the Saudi regime. They're in Afghanistan now, kind of feudally, hopefully doing these Hail Mary passes kinds of war-making strategies in the United States. In the same way, the Egyptians are no longer in Egypt fighting their regime, they're bombing the United States. Contrast this, say, with Hamas and the other folks at war against Israel. You don't hear about Hamas attacking the United States these days. Why? In a sense, they can target, there's space there in Palestine for them to carry on their war directly with the people they think that they're trying to oppose, in a way. So.
Do you share this view, Professor Krulak?
Sure, and I also think it's quite relevant. At this early stage, it appears that the hijackers were all from the same province of Saudi Arabia, and that's the Asir. It's a very rugged, mountainous province in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. And it's relevant for a couple of reasons. The Asir has largely been excluded from the benefits of oil revenues, and it's only in the last few years that material welfare has begun to trickle into that region. You just don't see the beautiful highways and telecommunications and the skyscrapers in the Asir that you see in Jeddah and in Riyadh. But also, the social identity in the Asir is different. The three provinces in the southwest of Saudi Arabia are sometimes called the Lost Provinces, and the implication is that they were taken from Yemen. And so that even today in the Asir, there's a much closer identity with Yemen than there is with the Saudi Arabian state, and certainly with the Al Saud family.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us for this very interesting roundtable discussion about Saudi Arabia. Gwen Akrulak has written on development and opposition in Saudi Arabia, teaches political science at the University of Arkansas. You can read her piece, Understanding Political Dissent in Saudi Arabia, at the MERIP website. That's MERIP.org. And thanks very much to Bob Vitalis, Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Forthcoming book, America's Kingdom. I look forward to reading it.
Thanks. I'm glad you're back online.
Well, it's great to be there. And folks, we look forward to seeing you live if you can make it to the screening that we're doing of the War and Peace Report on Saturday night, November 3rd. Patti Smith will be there live, singing, performing. We'll be with the whole Democracy Now! Crew bringing you the video screening of Democracy Now! In Exile that we've been broadcasting on community television stations around the country through Free Speech TV at Dish Networks Channel 9415. And through Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34 and 56 in New York, and community access stations around the country. That does it for the program. Those of you who want to get the Johann Galtung speech or Howard Zinn's or Noam Chomsky's on videotape, you can call 1-800-926-3921 or freespeech.org. That's 1-800-926-3921. And go to our website to get more information on our event tomorrow and the program itself at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Thanks to KPFA, KFCF, and all our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica, and to Downtown Community Television, where we're broadcasting in the Firehouse from the embattled studios in exile from WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg.